This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The Texas immigration law, known as SB 4, goes into effect briefly after the Supreme Court declines to intervene before it's blocked again by a lower appeals court. Plus, Bernie Sanders introduces a bill to create a 32-hour work week with what he claims would be no loss of wages. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We are joined today by my colleagues, columnists Alicia Finley and Kim Strassel. A law last year that was passed and signed by Governor Greg Abbott called SB 4 creates a state crime for non-citizens to cross the border from Mexico into Texas and also allows state judges to issue orders requiring people to exit the country. This was blocked by a district court judge who said that Texas's citing clause of the Constitution as an invasion does not fly in this circumstance and that immigration is preempted by federal authority. And here is where the procedural tangles begin. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals issued a temporary administrative stay to put that lower court ruling on hold while it considered the issue. That meant the Texas law might go into effect, at least for a time, unless the Supreme Court intervened, which it declined to do on Tuesday. Let's start with a clip of Texas Governor Greg Abbott celebrating that decision by the Supreme Court.
What it signals is there are six votes on the Supreme Court that say it's okay for Texas to go ahead and begin enforcing the law. And so that's a very consequential step that's been taken. It's not conclusive, but it's consequential for now. First thing I'm going to do is get back and talk to the leaders of the Texas Department of Public Safety, leaders of the National Guard, as well as local law enforcement, and make sure we're all in sync together about exactly how this is going to be enforced.
Accompanying Governor Greg Abbott were countless headlines saying that the Texas law was going to be enforced. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick said that Texas would start making arrests of migrants. But Alicia, hours later, the Fifth Circuit waded back in and put this law on hold again while scheduling a hearing for today, this morning, on a more permanent stay of the lower court ruling. Alicia, what's going on here?
So we need to backtrack first and just discuss what this law would do, right? And this law would essentially make it a misdemeanor to cross the border into Texas under state law. And it's punishable by up to 6 months in jail. And those who repeatedly cross the border would be essentially prosecuted. That would be prosecuted as a felony and they could be deported. Essentially, it would make it a state crime, not just a federal crime, to cross illegally and would allow this state to essentially also arrest migrants who come in. And this could include those who plan to claim asylum. This back and forth right now, or the last day or so, has been involving procedural issues and an administrative stay. And I disagree with the statement that we just heard. It's not really a victory for Texas. What the high court really decided to say, well, we really don't want to rule on the emergency docket that people keep criticizing us for ruling on. We're going to let this play out. The Fifth Circuit merit panel is going to make a decision on whether to grant an emergency stay. And we're not going to intervene at this point in the dispute. But potentially, if this isn't resolved soon, at least that's what Amy Coney Barrett said in her concurrence, then maybe there will be an opportunity for the appellants, which is the Biden administration, to ask us again to intervene. But we're not going to get into this at this point.
To my eye, this is a dispute about process, as Alicia explains. And an administrative stay, it's important to understand, is generally not a stay that is issued with a view toward the merits. It's a judge or a court trying to preserve the status quo until they can have the time, have a moment to look at the issue and decide whether to issue a longer term stay pending the broader appeal. And so here is a piece of the opinion by Justice Amy Coney Barrett, joined by Justice Brett Kavanaugh, explaining why they did not want the Supreme Court to intervene here. Justice Barrett writes, so far as I know, this court has never reviewed the decision of a court of appeals to enter or not enter an administrative stay. I would not get into the business. When entered, an administrative stay is supposed to be a short-lived prelude to the main event. I think it's unwise to invite emergency litigation in this court about whether a court of appeals abused its discretion at this preliminary step. There were some dissenting justices, a more heated dissent issued by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, joined by Justice Jackson, and then a more tepid dissent from Justice Elena Kagan. Here is a piece of what she says. She says, I do not think the Fifth Circuit's use of an administrative stay rather than a stay pending appeal should matter. Administrative stays surely have their uses, but a court's unreasoned decision to impose one for more than a month rather than answer the stay pending appeal issue before it should not spell the difference between respecting and revoking long settled immigration law. But Kim, what I think is also notable in this opinion from Justice Barrett and Justice Kavanaugh is they give an elbow to the Fifth Circuit. And they say that the lower appeals court should be able to take up this question about whether to keep the Texas law in effect or to keep it blocked while they are hearing the appeal pretty promptly. And it seems that the Fifth Circuit, or at least the panel that's assigned to this case, took the hint within a matter of hours.
Yeah, the way to read the Barrett-Kavanaugh written opinion here is exactly as you said, that they are focused on the correct issue at the moment, which is procedure. There is a difference between a temporary administrative stay issued in order to give a court more time to decide how they're going to handle this and whether or not they're going to issue a stay pending appeal, in which they really need to look at the merits of that decision. And this has all happened a bit in a rush. So what they're saying, essentially, the conservatives on the court are, hey, step back, let's give the court the time it needs to actually go through the issues here, rather than their issuing something done in haste and rather are intervening before that process has been seen all the way through. I like it too, because it's in, I think, very stark contrast to the way everybody else is attempting to read this, whether it's Governor Abbott who's saying, hey, look, this high court said we have the green light to go ahead with this law. No, that was not what that opinion said at all. Or, you know, the minority judges on the Supreme Court who were already using this as an opportunity to explain why this is such an egregious law and why it should be struck down before the Fifth Circuit has really had a chance to go through things itself. Yes, this opinion from Barrett and Kavanaugh did come with a little bit of a warning, which was, hey, we're going to give you some time to go through this procedure, okay, but get on with it. And also a little bit of a warning, which was, if you don't get on with it, we might indeed have to intervene. And so, yes, that was the Fifth Circuit responding to it. They very hurriedly arranged some oral arguments. They put a block back on the law while they're doing that. And hopefully this gets the lower courts back on track, doing the process all the way it's supposed to be done, which is what you would like to see the Supreme Court do and sort of ask the lower courts to do once in a while.
Alicia, what's your view when these courts eventually get to the merits? There is a landmark case in the Supreme Court, Arizona v. U.S. in 2012, blocking a law in Arizona trying to enforce immigration restrictions. And to my eye, at least some of what Texas is trying to do here is covered by that precedent. So I am skeptical that this law is eventually going to go into effect, because the idea that a state could order people to leave the country, that sure sounds like a matter of national immigration policy. And so if the Fifth Circuit comes to that conclusion as well, it's possible we might not even get a Supreme Court case on this. Maybe Texas is trying to reverse that precedent, trying to get the justices to reverse Arizona v. U.S., but it's also possible they could decide the Fifth Circuit had it right and not even take this case.
Right. So there are various ways that this case could go. Now, in Arizona v. U.S., which involved a very similar provision in the Arizona law that made it a crime to be unlawfully present in the U.S., the majority said, and it was, again, it was a 6-2 majority, that Congress intended to preclude states from complementing federal law or enforcing additional or auxiliary regulations. Now, this kind of gets to an issue in the court's jurisprudence that involves preemption. And there are different kinds of preemption. There's conflict preemption, in which most justices are united in believing that when a state law directly conflicts with the federal law, that the federal law rules supreme under the Supremacy Clause. Now, there's another area called field preemption or implied preemption, where a state law may not directly conflict, but the federal government has regulated an area, such as immigration, has set forth a detailed scheme of regulating, and where states are implicitly preempted from regulating. Now, the conservatives on the court, I think, are actually very divided on this issue of implied preemption, and we've seen that in other cases that have come before the court, in terms of like drug and FDA approvals and such, and states being able to regulate, or even uranium mining, for instance. So on the merits, I think the conservatives may be a little split, with Justice Gorsuch and Justice Thomas being a little more sympathetic to Texas's argument. But I think the problem here is that Texas's law actually directly conflicts with federal law, insofar that it allows or makes it a state crime to be in Texas, even if you're someone who plans to claim asylum. And it also really undercuts another point that the Justice Department is making, is the federal government's and the administration's ability to manage foreign affairs and relationships with Mexico. Mexico has already said, well, we're not accepting anyone that Texas plans to send back. And this is going to create a real tension in terms of foreign relations. And I think Chief Justice Roberts in particular, but other justices, have been deferential to that claim by the federal government whenever it's come before the court.
Hang tight. We'll be right back in a moment.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Welcome back. Let's turn to Bernie Sanders, who recently introduced the 32-Hour Workweek Act, which he argues would move the U.S. to a 32-hour workweek over 4 years with, quote, no loss of pay. Let's listen to Bernie tangling with a Fox Business reporter over this idea last week.
We held a hearing on a 32-hour workweek because what we have seen is that over the last 50 years, despite a huge increase in worker productivity, almost all of the new wealth has gone to the top 1%, while 60% of the people are living paycheck to paycheck. Many of our people are exhausted. We work the longest hours of any people in the industrialized world. I think it's time for a shortened work week.
Can I ask you a question about that? It seems like Democrats want businesses to be taxed more,
really?
pay their workers more, lower prices, and now pay people not to work.
You know what I would like to see?
How are businesses going to survive that? That's the question. How can businesses survive all of those proposals?
When Mr. Bezos pays an effective tax rate lower than the average worker, I think we have a real problem in our tax system. I think that billionaires have got to start paying their fair share of taxes.
Kim, what do you make of this idea from the Vermont Independent Socialist? It seems to me this has no chance of passing in the current Senate, but it's notable that Bernie Sanders has proved in some cases to be the leading edge of his party on things like Medicare for All, a $15 minimum wage, which used to be laughed at and now are increasingly adopted by mainstream Democrats.
Yes, be scared, very, very scared, because if Bernie starts to push it, it will very soon become the demand of the left and part of their platform and what they begin pushing for in the Senate. Now, this is absolutely nuts, by the way. In fact, I heard one conservative critic say it's a little bit like a high school kid running for elementary school president and promising to get rid of homework and make every day ice cream Friday. But we do have to know that there have been moves like this to do stuff equivalent. I mean, France, for instance, has a less than 40-hour work week, a 35-hour work week. You've had some states that have investigated a four-day work week. Massachusetts and Pennsylvania hasn't gone anywhere. Now, the reason it hasn't is because there are enormous economic consequences for this. It's all well and good to have these people say, oh, you know, one of the benefits of artificial intelligence and automation and new technology is it's just going to free up humanity to think big thoughts and they won't have to work as much every day. Maybe, but we are not there yet. And these kind of proposals right now, they would put extraordinary strain, in particular on small businesses. You'd end up with fewer jobs. You'd end up with increased inflation as a function of how this all washed out in wages. You'd probably have more automation, which is weird because one of the people that's supporting this is Sean Fain, the head of United Auto Workers. And they have been fighting against automation because it loses unions jobs, many, many of them. So it is not a well thought out proposal, but as you heard there, it's in keeping with this rage that many on the left have that there are some people in society that have a lot of money. And I guess until everybody in their perfect world, much like old-fashioned Soviets, can make everybody equal in some way, shape, or form, they're not going to rest.
Alicia, my thought is that the money has to come from somewhere, and it is amazing how this legislation attempts to simply decree that it will not come from anywhere. So there's one piece of this that Bernie keeps pointing to say employers would not be able to cut your wages as a result of this 20% decrease in hours worked. And here is what the legislation says with respect to employees brought within the purview of this section. The employer may not reduce the total workweek compensation rate or any other employee benefit. And I guess that prompts two thoughts from me. One is that, okay, so if the employer cannot reduce the total workweek compensation rate, what if the employer just stops giving out raises? And if you have 5% employment for a few years, then pretty soon you are back where you started without any of this protection that Bernie Sanders is promising. And what about new hires? Maybe the Bernie legislation would be able to protect people who are brought within the purview of his 32-hour workweek act if they're already employed. But it seems to me that one obvious choice for a business would be to hire new employees on different terms. And then you'd end up with a labor market that is fractured and people not wanting to leave jobs they've had for a long time because they are grandfathered in to this 32-hour workweek act under their old wages and they don't want to take a new job. I agree with Kim. This seems like it is not very thought out, not very workable. And I don't know. I mean, does Bernie even want this to pass or is this a messaging bill?
Well, a couple of points. What you were getting at is the distortionary effects, which are always very hard to predict and can depend on the elasticity of the labor market and so forth. And if you're in a recession, you'll probably see layoffs. I think that's a variable. The irony, of course, is that the people who would be hurt most by this are, you know, working class people, because it would apply to wage earners and people on salary wouldn't really affect, right? And another point is that, well, France enshrined a 35-hour work week in 2000, and they thought, well, if everyone was working less, then this would force employers to hire more people. That hasn't actually turned out to be. In fact, unemployment remains pretty high in France and higher than the other places that have 40-hour work weeks. And the labor mobility is quite low. People, as you mentioned, and there are other reasons for that, job protections in France, but the labor market is pretty sclerotic. And that's one reason France, its GDP, its economy has grown much slower than the U.S. Now, does Bernie actually want this to pass? Yes, I think he does. I think he actually believes in this. He's not a serious economist, would laugh this out, including those on the left, because they know how distortionary the impact of this would be. But I think, as you point out, he's an ideologue and a demagogue. So I think he's really pushing this just because it's kind of a socialistic idea that corporations should have to pay workers more, even though they work less. Again, this would be equivalent to about a 20% de facto raise. And this is a way to squeeze corporations, in fact, when it would actually squeeze workers.
My last thought on this is I think that Bernie is ignoring the massive increase in living standards. So he says, this is a quote from his press release, today, American workers are over 400% more productive than they were in the 1940s. And yet millions of Americans are working longer hours for lower wages than they were decades ago. But go back to the 1940 census and look at the percentage of homes that did not have any refrigeration or were using ice as refrigeration or did not have central heat or did not even have a radio, did not have a flush toilet. Look at the healthcare that we have, the better food that we have, the longer lifespans. The Social Security Administration says life expectancy at birth in 1940 was 61.5 for males and 65.7 for females. And yes, most people work 40 hours a week or more than that, but they are also having all of these better amenities and often long retirements. Hang tight. We'll be right back after one more break.
WSJ Special Access gives you a front row seat to some of the Wall Street Journal's most exciting content, like The Quirkier Side of Life, a new series that features the fun, surprising stories our reporters come across.
The chief executive walks 10,000 barefoot steps every day. He recalls stepping on a bee, which put him off earthing for a couple of days, but he got back to it.
Check out The Quirkier Side of Life on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Let's take a question from a listener. Trevor in Pittsburgh says he's a longtime listener of the podcast, but a first-time writer to our email address. He had a question about the House bill requiring TikTok to no longer be a Chinese company, and he says he fears that it's a slippery slope. Is there no way for the free market to intervene in the situation? Apple and Google have no problem removing apps from their stores. Why is there no public pressure for them to block new downloads of TikTok? Unquote. Kim, what do you make of that?
Well, first of all, I love it when people write in questions to us. And this is a very good one because it's a thoughtful one. And I am completely in agreement, always have been, that if there's any scenario that is remotely possible in which we can look to the free market to solve something, that's what we should be doing. We have a history in which we make this mistake again and again in too many situations in which you get a company that's very large, very popular. There's some concern about it pretty soon. Public sentiment and political sentiment is that government needs to intervene. I can't even tell you the long list of companies that when, in fact, even when left alone and there wasn't government interference, they are now in the dustbin of history simply because they didn't manage to continue competing. And so while they looked dominant and important at a time, the market itself corrected many of those problems. However, we have always understood that there are some very unique circumstances in which the free market alone can't function, in part because of political interference. And that includes by foreign adversaries who seek to use companies to, for instance, gather intelligence or somehow engage in an enterprise that is designed to damage or undermine the security of the United States. It's why we have federal bodies like the Committee on Foreign Investment, which looks at some of these things. That this doesn't mean that, by the way, you should get nervous every time a Japanese company comes and buys a skyscraper in New York, but it's an admission that some countries are indeed our adversaries and use corporations. And that's the situation you're talking about in TikTok. It's great to think, for instance, that maybe you could get another buyer for TikTok, that this would happen organically. It's clearly not going to happen so long as the Chinese government is benefiting from getting information from this firm and isn't going to willingly allow it to be sold. And I guess, yes, you could rally pressure on Google and Apple to do that, except for that public opinion right now is a mercurial thing. And there's about as many people in the country that adore TikTok as those that recognize the threat from it. And in that scenario, neither Google or Apple is going to somehow eliminate this incredibly popular app that is on their site at the moment. So I think that we sometimes have to look at certain scenarios and say, this is simply a big problem from a national security perspective. I worry, too, about the slippery slope. I hope that this is not a situation that puts us where you can easily start banning other companies right and left on spurious national security reasonings. But at the same time, too, I got to hope or at least pray that those who are getting these national security briefings in Congress are hearing evidence that really does give them cause for concern.
Thank you, Kim and Alicia. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button, and we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.